Once the first vows are taken, and the person enters into the external apostolic work, obedience will involve things that are not just routine. They can be specific ways of doing things, or prohibition from doing something else. And it may well be that the individual knows more about what they're told to do than the superior who gives the order. Moreover, and this is the hard one that I've adverted to, I know, at least sometime last year. Once you're in the act of apostolate, the one you're responsible to may be not only the superior, but the administrator or other people to whom you are somehow subject. They're often lay people that are in charge of things. To maintain one's spirit of obedience and also maintain a balance between, well, knowing what I know and doing it according to my best knowledge, and being humbly submissive even to lay people who may have legitimate charge of a department or a section of the work that I'm engaged in. The Little Sisters of the Poor. It reminds me, I had a call from a little sister of the poor this morning before I came up. One of their problems, they are not unique, but I think they can specially be pointed out, a good community. But the state requires a very large lay personnel so that all of the houses have several times as many lay people as there are religious. That, let me tell you, is not healthy for religious life. But where there's no choice, the question then is, whom do I obey? In fact, some religious tell me, after they enter into the act of apostate, after first vows, their problem is, I'd be very happy to obey the superior. My problem is, I'm always getting directives from the, say, lay administrator. And there's such a thing as maintaining one's religious respect, dignity, and even rights. Because then what may still be called obedience may be such a complicated adjustment of oneself to other people, and you're never sure who has what rights to tell me what to do. Thirdly, the virtue of poverty. In the nature of things, after leaving the novitiate, things must be used, must be bought, money is available, and again, as with chastity, so with poverty. The religious may simply not know how to cope with some of these things. Religious, let me tell you, are notorious in the business world for not knowing the value of money. I've heard this from any number of professional lay business people. They don't understand the value of money. They would either be so, you might say, parsimonious, watching every penny, and they make unwise decisions to save a dollar here, you will buy some cheaper product or material, and in the process, waste thousands of dollars. Or on the other hand, they may be so careless and indifferent to the use of money that they will waste it because they don't appreciate how hard it is, say, to earn an honest dollar. How many religious have told me, especially young religious, the food they eat, the care they have, the facilities, the things at their disposal. As one girl recently told me, I never had this at home before we entered the community. As I could say, I still have one more point. What number are we on?
This will be
13. That's exactly my number. I have five recommendations that are number 13. Just a word about each. During this period, therefore, from first to last vows, the religious needs spiritual counsel. Be sure they get it. Secondly, they need a wise confessor. Be sure they get one. Third, they need companionship. Be sure they have it, the right kind, and not the wrong kind. Fourth, they need directives. They've got to be told what to do and what not to do. And fifth, and only the Lord can give them this, but they need prudence. Should watch others, pray, and where they're imprudent, be told to use their heads. Brother.
Father, I'd like to ask you a question concerning to you. Do I have an obligation, if I'm living in a situation, to say, where there seems to be a consistent disregard for the constitutional norms, or particular norms of the Constitution, do I have an obligation to confront the superior if the neglect remains consistent? And is it reflected, if I do, is that a poor attitude on my part, or does it reflect prudence?
Well, I would say there are two guiding norms that I would recommend. The first is whether I am in the position to make such a representation. In other words, it depends on what my role or place in the community is. Now, there are things which you might say are everybody's business, but there are certain things that are, you might say, not exactly my business. And maybe legitimately the superior could feel that I'm going beyond my rights in this case to call his or her attention to that. And I think even to be listened to by the superior in those cases, I would look to that first norm that I am suggesting to justify my bringing this up. In other words, why should I, why not somebody else? Because if it's fairly open and public, I could well say to myself, well, it's no more my responsibility than someone else's. Now, in most cases, the representation should be made. The individual who makes the representation to the superior can justify the representation by saying, well, somehow it affects my work or the people that are working with me or for me. In other words, I would look for some justifying reason so the superior will not feel, now if it's grave enough, well then, say it regardless. But the point is not merely to make the representation, but to get something done. So I would say there ought to be some justifying reason for my calling it to the superior's attention. Secondly, and this is the hard one, it is not enough to make the representation that something is out of order, which the superior should take care of and maybe has been overlooking or even positively neglecting. It is something else to know the solution to the problem that perhaps gives rise to this abuse. And this is where I have found, when I've had occasion to do this, it can't always be done, but in many cases it can be done, where I would first of all think through. I don't just rush to the conclusion something should be said and drop it, as it were, at the superior's doorstep and then walk away. Think through why the problem exists, how the superior could cope with it, and best of all, offer to help. Does that make sense? Now, when would an individual in a community be exempt from making such representation, which covers many things, where it would obviously do no good and might even create a rift between the superior and myself, either because I've tried it before or others have tried it and nothing was done? And I trust I'm not speaking to people in communities where this is the common practice. All I can say is that there are many secularized communities today where making representation would be worse than useless.
I find, Father, something is bothering me. If I really pray, I will usually have these patients. I will always, if it's something really important, make a 9-day novena. By the time the novena is ended, God
has
taken care of it himself.
Well, that may be, and I would say this is thank God for the fact.
That's right. That's
but there are communities in which the situation is simply not that way. And there are limits, of course, to representation. There's a representation to the local superior. There's a representation to the provincial or regional superior, to the general, and then, if need be, to the Holy See. But these are things which, in my own work with villages, all I can tell you is that not infrequently, even representations to the Holy See, because of the conditions of that community, Rome would have to say, in some cases, in many cases, the risk or the consequences of correcting that abuse, the cost would be greater than, as bad as it is, leaving it go. There is such a thing as the lesser of not just two evils, but the lesser of a dozen evils.
So you're speaking of cases where these norms weren't followed in the first place.
Yes, yes. In other words, things can get so bad that the only thing to do would be to dissolve the order or dissolve the religious institute. In the near future, the Holy Father is going to make a major change in a major religious order in the church, because all other means have failed. And I'm not sure, and I don't think he's sure, that even the change he's making will correct the evil. In other words, we're living in a very real world in which secularism has deeply penetrated many communities, and I would say every community has at least its share of the inroads. Yes, brother.
Would you not say, though, I mean, we've been speaking about the virtue of our consecration to Almighty God in the religious life. Would you not say that the obedience, if we're obedient, everything sort of falls into place? Do you know what I'm saying? I mean,
yes, except
we're looking at the vows, the virtue of the vows separately. I realize that, and that we've got to do that. But would you not agree that if we're obedient, we're poor and we're chaste, both spiritually and physically?
Yes, on one condition, brother. And the tragedy is that in today's world, that condition is not always fulfilled. On condition that the authority I obey is itself obedient to the church's magisterium. That's the issue. Our faith tells us, and what an act of faith this is, our faith tells us that there is in the world an ultimate visible authority which, if obeyed, will bless us in every possible way.
But would you not also say, Father, I know we're getting on to the vows now, and this is a formation class, but would you not also say, even if the superior is, shall I say, wrong about something, you're still bound to obey him? Or her, for that matter. I'm not saying that it'd be wrong with something that it would be contrary to the constitution of the religious order or congregation or whatever. But
well,
no matter.
Well, I would say that the wrongness, and of course, if the superior is wrong, well, then he is not to be obeyed. The problem is that so often in communities where the superior is de facto wrong, if you don't obey, you suffer terrible consequences. I'd like to read, I'm looking at the document of Pope Paul VI, Religious Life, the exhortation. Remember? Evangelica Testificatio. This occurs in number 28, the famous number 28. This is not the best translation, but it will serve. The Pope is talking about conscience and obedience. Now, he is urging the religious to be obedient and submit even his conscience, which should be enlightened by authority. When in order, he is manifestly contrary to the laws of God, all the constitutions of the Institute, or one involving a serious and certain evil, there is no obligation to obey. Now, would that this statement of the Pope were a mere rhetorical flourish? This is a painful, traumatic fact of life in hundreds of institutes in the church today. Hundreds. And consequently, the most important, there's nothing comparing with this, the most important thing in a religious community today is that the superiors themselves be fully and totally submissive to the church's authority. So I would say, brother, the question you ask, until the last 15 or so years, could be answered yes. Even though you think the superior is wrong, go ahead and obey him or her anyhow, because you could be sure, morally certain, that the superiors themselves, though mistaken often, were themselves sincerely obedient. But not all superiors. I'm talking about major superiors. I'm talking about superiors general, who are not, notoriously, are not obedient. And they know they're not. Like the mother general, while she was president of the LCWR, and I have it in writing from her because I wanted to be able to quote it. When I asked her to tell me what she considered the authority of the Bishop of Rome, she said, this is a direct quotation, "The Pope is the highest counselor in the Catholic Church. He has no right to command, no right to command obedience under pain of sin." That's the quotation from the then president of the LCWR with 600 religious superiors belonging to it. So, brother.
Excuse me, Father, for just saying this, but I'm not saying that, you know, if the superior tells you, say, to jump out the window, that you should do it.
Brother, I know whom I'm talking to. You are not experienced in what this is. You have not tasted it. You don't know, brother. Honestly, you just don't know what's going on in some institutes today.
Yes.
And God bless you for not knowing. I hope you never learn. Hope you never have the experience. All I can tell you is, it's going on. And of course, those coming to the classes here, this is why I'm here. Thank God there are communities like yours still in existence. And the Holy See is happy that you are in existence and happy with the Institute that are helping to keep such communities in existence. But there are others. Are there ever?
This concludes Father John Hardin's talk on the development of the religious life after first profession.